Remove your lower garments and face away from me.
Can I say that you say that to all the girls?
Hello and welcome to the Frollcast. I'm Erin.
I'm Monica.
And we are the Farscape Friends, this week talking about episode 307, Thanks for Sharing, written by Clavon Harris and directed by Ian Barry, both first-timers on Farscape.
Huh.
Huh.
I can see it.
Clavon Barry's, I looked up their IMDb's. I mean, Clavon Barry, that's a portmanteau. Clavon Harris, previous writing credits, pretty minimal, but included both Living Single and Voyager. So
nice.
A man of many talents, I think. Ian Barry, first episode also that he directed, and he only goes on to direct one more, and it's Meltdown. So we'll be seeing him again for that episode.
Yeah, we will.
And I'm sure we'll enjoy it. But for now, we're at Thanks for Sharing. We're living in a world of two Johns, which is pretty convenient this week for what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. You told me before we started recording today that you were not super jazzed about this episode.
I am not super jazzed about this episode. It just doesn't grab me. It feels a lot like it's sort of like, last week you said, you talked about how Eat Me could just be the episode where John is split in two, like the episode with two Johns, and it's not that. I feel like this is very much the episode after there are two Johns. Mm. And like the whole point of this episode is figuring out what happens to the Johns, and it's just all of this extra maneuvering to kind of make the split happen that ends up happening, where you have one John on Talon and one John on Moya.
Yeah. I think the word you described is that it didn't grab your attention or hold your attention, which is interesting because I also sort of had lukewarm feelings going into watching it. And I do think that sense of a transitional or a setup episode is really predominant here. But at the same time, I kept finding little things about it that I really liked. And actually a few things I thought Monica probably caught into this and enjoyed it too, but maybe I was wrong. We can talk about it.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Well, let's start with having a look at that there promo.
Next Friday on an original episode of Farscape.
Missiles? No one's from the planet.
You've been screwing me from the beginning.
Boy is sensitive peacekeeper scan.
You've been lying to your daddy, boy. It's gonna stop.
Fire concussion missiles.
Now tell him.
Cargo, tell him who his daddy is.
You must listen.
I'm your daddy.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
Farscape, next Friday.
So that's kind of a weird promo to me.
I feel like the promo is representative of the episode in that there's a lot of yelling and a lot of people I don't care about, and I'm not really sure what's going on.
It really is a promo of a scene, one scene pretty late in the episode, interspersed with a few cuts.
Yeah.
And then basically also the very end of the episode.
Yeah.
There's no indication of two Johns. It's a lot of stuff that I think is meant to grab us visually and make us interested, which I guess is the work of a good promo, but it doesn't have much to say about the story or the general kind of plot things happening. So
yeah.
Should
I take a stab at those plot things?
Clear up for us what's happening.
Okay, so we have Moya and Talon, and Talon's really injured and Krace is unconscious. And Moya and Talon have found a planet where the crew can go get chlorium?
Chromextin.
Chromextin. Okay, where they can go get Chromextin, which is something that will help Talon feel better, like shades of IET here. And then they go down to this planet and there's a bunch of just nonsense because this family controls everything in this sector that they've landed in. And there's like palace intrigue happening. And the security officer, who is also the son of the ruler, sexually harasses Chiana, and Dargo like punches him, which seems reasonable, but, you know, is not super reasonable when you need something from the guy you're punching. So there's just a lot of like shenanigans after that. And one, I think the most plotty shenanigan is that John has the ruling guy has a daughter and a son, like basically Ivanka and Trump children's sons merged together as one. So John has a secret meeting with What's-Her-Face, and then somebody sabotages the meeting by deploying a bomb that looks like Jell-O and then combines to make a bomb. And then, like, John is badly injured and secreted away, but the other John comes down and outsmarts their lie-detecting lobster scorpion that sits on people's heads and makes them tell the truth. And then he applies said lobster scorpion to the sun, and it kills the sun. And in the end, they get two barrels of chlorhexidine. I've literally already forgotten what it was. Chromextin. I'm fucking it up. It's fine. So they get like two barrels of it, but it's contaminated with chlorium. This time, which is the anesthetic thing that we learned about in IET that can hurt leviathans if there is too much of it and they're injured. So they have to, like, separate the poison out from the good stuff. And also, Krace wakes up and tells them that Talon is being pursued by a peacekeeper retrieval squad because they want their fancy gunship back and will stop at almost nothing to get it. And he has a video of the time that Aaron's mom came to her room to tell her that she was special as a baby. And he gives Aaron a copy of it. And then at the end of the episode, we find out that Aaron's mother, Zalax, is the leader of the retrieval squad. And to kind of evade that, Talon and Moya both starburst independently, and the way it shakes out is that you have Krace, Ajon, Aaron, Rigel, and Stark on Talon, and then Jewel, Chiana, Dargo, another John, and Pilot on Moya. Did I forget anybody?
I don't remember. I wasn't listening that closely.
Great. So basically, half the cast on one ship, half the cast on the other, off to separately try to evade these peacekeepers. So now we've established an arc. And then at the very, very end of the episode, the daughter takes her face off to reveal that she is a Skaren, maybe, or some other kind of alien. She looks like, I mean, it's like a big, a big buggy looking giant alien thing, and we see it have a meeting with Zalax and be like, I failed, aren't you gonna kill me? And Zalax is just like, come on, we're leaving. And then we have kind of set up where the rest of the season is going.
Yeah, this episode is interesting in that it is more of an independent story than we've seen lately in some ways, but it's also so much set up an introduction to the arc that really takes up a good chunk of the third season. And I think we might as well just get this out of the way now. It would be hard to avoid spoiling this.
Yeah.
But that is how a portion of season three, I won't talk about how much exactly, is done, is that it goes between the two ships, trading off episodes, and you now have the two Johns who are referred to colloquially as MJ and TJ, Moya John and Talon John. And I'm not sure, I haven't looked up quite any information, but I imagine it had to do with like budgeting considerations and maybe saving the actors some of the stress that had been present for the first two seasons of filming. Everything I've ever seen was that it was a very hectic and busy schedule, and to give everyone kind of a break for a little bit by having kind of a half-duty filming was maybe part of their goal there, I can imagine. But we are in this episode to set up all that stuff, And in the meantime, I do think there's some good stuff about this one. I think the more times I watched it, the more I liked it. And I watched it this morning again to kind of remind myself.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there are definitely, like, cute, funny things in it. Mm. But if I look away for a second, it's like I look up and 5 minutes have passed and I don't know where we are again.
There is also a lot going on.
Yeah.
Because you have sort of a storyline going on Talon. You have three main locations.
Right.
The planet, Moyen, Talon. And you have a bunch of people traveling in between those mm-hmm. and changing who's on what. It's sort of this kind of ball and cup game for a while of where everybody's going to end up.
Yeah.
And then you're also doing the bait and switch with the Johns.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of this local politics, guest cast stuff happening. I didn't think it was too much, but I guess you did.
Uh-huh. I did.
Okay. The Rinnicks, Papa Rinnick, and then the girl Rinnick and the boy Rinnick is how I'm referring to them.
Works for me.
I know they have names, but I think those are more fun ways to refer to them. But speaking, as you did a few minutes ago, about sort of humor, we don't get that much of the two Johns together, and I'm sure a lot of that had to do with budget constraints in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
So you sort of get this initial scene that I quite like of the two Johns and Aaron trying to deal with them.
Yeah.
But not much more after that.
I know it's not as bad as the last time. It's not the Cro-Magnon copy or the Alien Nation reject, but you can tell I'm the original, right?
Wrong. I'm the original.
Try again, pal. Have you been messing with my stuff?
That's my stuff.
And you are the clone. Aaron, you can tell.
You can see the difference.
No, I can't. Right. Here. You wear that, so I can tell the two of you apart.
Wait, why do I have to wear it?
Because you're closer. I want to help you sort this all out, but we have bigger problems right now. Talon is dying.
But Pilot thinks the Chromexin will fix Talon up, right?
If Dargo can find it on the planet.
You should have gone down with him.
Screw you. I'm not going to leave Krace alone on Moya.
He is comatose and locked in a medical stabilizer. He does not need guarding from either of you.
I don't trust him.
And what if he's lying?
Fine. You go and keep an eye on Krace. And you go to Talon and help Stark.
Excuse me. Why me?
One, poor Aaron. She is so visibly stressed out by this.
Yeah.
She does not know what to do with herself. Because two Johns is too many Johns.
Yes.
You get a lot of diminishing returns on the number of Johns in your life. And I think two feels much more like babysitting than it should. They are still incredibly salty about the fact that there are two of them and very confrontational about it.
Yeah.
Just throwing around, you're a fucking copy. You're the fucking copy. Like, they're so mad about it. My only other note on this scene is you can 1,000% tell that the double in one of the scenes is not Ben, even a little bit.
Yeah, it's like
It's really clear.
Yeah, it was not great.
So everybody who was harboring sexy ideas about
two
Johns and one Aaron should probably sheathe those. I think this scene, yeah, burst a bubble. Yeah, I think we just go through this episode, but don't talk about every scene because
I won't remember them all.
Yeah, there's too many scenes to talk about, but we'll hit the interesting things as we go. So they go down to this planet, Camvia, which is one of the more advanced, I guess, societies that they've visited. It's pretty future-y, right?
Yeah, I think it's fair to middling in the futuristicness department. It's not primitive.
The Camvians, and they immediately piss off the security. Yeah. The guy, the biggest douche.
Such a douche. He's so gross. He's so gross. And I was like, how did I forget that this happened in Farscape?
He's dressed like a shitty internet man.
Yeah.
whose social media accounts are all dedicated to like MRA stuff, and like he should have a ponytail, I think is the only way that I can describe this dude.
Yeah.
Like, he does have a wonderfully shitty beard.
It's like his Twitter avatar is Neo from The Matrix.
Yeah, he's definitely, definitely racist.
Yeah. And he drops a food down Chiana's cleavage.
He is extremely aggressive towards Chiana. And she deals with it pretty well.
And I love the line about, like, I'm not trying to start trouble. And he's like, you haven't. And then Dargo immediately socks him.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
And he deserved it. Yeah. Because he was just up in her biz in a bad way.
Yeah.
Not a good dude. Which is a shame, because his sister's a little foxy.
She has good bangs.
She has a good dress. The slits and the high boots.
Yeah.
I bet her social media accounts are dope.
It looks very much like early 2000s, like, rave wear that they have.
Yeah, there's a lot of black.
Yeah.
And leathery substances and, like,
a lot of pleather.
We have cool nightclubs kind of vibe.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the antithesis of the Royal Planet from Look at the Princess.
Yeah.
Like, it's the opposite color scheme, but it has a similar vibe.
Yeah.
But they're, like you said, trying to find these
The Lennets. Yeah.
Lennets of Chromexton, which is, there's a lot of, like, science bogginess in this episode.
None of it's good.
There are a few things that Jewel comes up with that I was like, I bet Monica liked that, but who knows? So after Dargo and Chiana screw everything up, but not really, because it was 100,000,000% Boy Rennick's fault.
Yes.
And I'm on their team, but they're still fucked because the system. We come back and we are having some fixing of Talon going on. Stark suddenly, okay, this is the thing I wanted to talk about. Stark is suddenly, like, really knowledgeable about how to fix Leviathans and how to fix, like, Talon in particular. He's sort of, with Krace, seeming to, like, run the repair operation.
Well, who else is going to do it?
I'm not saying nobody else. We have no established anything of any kind that Stark knows anything about fixing ships.
Yeah.
Or conduits or repairing things. He hasn't even lived on Moya that long.
No, he really hasn't. I was going to say, is it stuff that he picked up, like, during the shenanigans that have happened in recent episodes?
Possibly. It's not a big nitpick. It just, all of a sudden, Stark's, like, telling John how to do the fixing of Talon.
Right.
Which seems weird to me. I don't know that that makes sense.
I think I had just assumed that he was repeating what someone else had told him.
Probably. But he does take this sort of lead role in the rest of the episode. Like, that's what he's doing the entire episode, is just, like, hunkered down fixing Talon.
Yeah.
And kind of directing other people's attentions with the fixing Talon situation. And it's just a little bit out of the left field, is all I'm saying.
Well, first-time writers.
Yes. Yeah, they're actually, one of the things that was kind of funny about the first-time writer, and I'm not sure if this is other writers in the room punching up, but there did seem to be a lot of references to the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Stark does a my side, your side joke, but it feels really out of place. John says some stuff about species they've encountered before.
Yeah.
There's all these kind of, like, slightly out of place throwbacks, and I couldn't tell if that was the writer who's credited on the episode trying to be like, look, I belong, I know what's going on, or if it was other writers trying to make it seem more natural from a source that didn't have a lot of references.
That is an interesting point. I don't know which it is, though. Six of one, half a dozen of the other?
I guess, yeah.
That is a good point.
So, yeah, then we find out that I don't know. The Johns are both, like, up Jules' ass, trying to get her to confirm that they're both the real one, and she's just like, fuck this shit. There's something that she says to John while she's trying to care for Crace about... He's assuming that she has some expertise in the medical field, and she had... We had talked about this a few episodes ago, where it was like, oh, is her, like, hypercompetency in an academic sense related to her inability to do other things? But I think it's a little more nuanced than that. In fact, I was thinking about you and how you have an expertise in public health, mm-hmm. but not you couldn't necessarily, like, perform surgery.
Public health and medicine are two different fields.
Right. But, like, so is neuroscience and, xenobiology.
Right.
And doing the sort of things that she said. So I thought you might identify with that.
I did.
Some way.
Yeah. I did enjoy it. And I think it seemed very convenient that Jewel is just here to take over doctoring from Zan, even if she's flailing a little bit.
Yeah, they definitely... I feel bad, though, because the show needs a doctor.
Yes, it does.
Needs somebody who kind of knows what they're doing. And I think last episode, they had Stark, like, fixing up Chiana, right?
Yes.
At the end.
Yeah.
But then now they have, I guess, Jewel doing it.
Well, and I think that also depends on what kind of fixing up you need. Like, it seemed to me that Chiana needed more psychological fixing up than physical injury.
I thought I saw him tending to, like, some wounds of hers or something. Like, because she got cut, right?
Yeah, but, like, anybody can slap a Band-Aid on. It's not difficult.
All right, fine.
And Jewel is more like, oh, let me practice xenobiology on Crace. Nobody likes him.
I do like that her little scanning tool when she's, like, standing over Crace is so clearly a shower head with lights on it.
Yep. And, like, painted a color.
Yeah, painted that kind of Moya bronze.
And, like, we've never seen that tool before.
No.
We're never going to see that tool again.
We might. Keep a watch out.
Okay, I'll keep an eye out.
Speaking of the good lines, though, one of my favorites is John doing his sweeter than the sweet thing. Like, what is this? I think both versions of John are reverting to this weirdly southern affects.
Yeah.
To, like, prove a sort of abstract authenticity.
Yeah.
Wow. What?
That was a hell of an insight.
But I do like that Jewel is complaining about there not being anything sweet to eat.
Yeah, that I found extremely relatable.
Yes. Hashtag yes, please. I would be very mad if I went on the ship and there was nothing to eat.
I also really love how at one point John comes in and is haranguing her about, you know, like, prove that I'm the real one. And she gives him attitude about, like, you want me to do this thing for you that's, like,
yeah,
irrelevant and a waste of resources right now.
Yeah.
And, like, we're all stretched to our limits. Like, why should I do this for you?
Yeah, one of the things I do like sort of related to that is later in the episode, Jewel thinks she's done.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Helping with something. And she's like, all right, well, I've had a long day. Because she doesn't quite realize that you can't clock out of Moya yet.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm just going to go back to my room now. Right. Bye. And everyone's like, no. You have more to do. You get to sleep when all of us get to sleep.
Right.
Which is, it's a small thing, but it's very well observed.
Yeah.
Of, like, how somebody new to the game would not necessarily realize that this is not something you can just avoid.
Yeah.
You can't just avoid participating in Moya life.
Right.
Another thing that is early on in this episode is that, switching back to the sort of Rinnix and Linnets and Tremexton story, is that we have the Moya rep coming back in. Speaking of the Moya ethos, we now have the rep of the crew being a factor in this episode.
Reputation. I got it. You said rep and I was like a sales representative, like a reps at the gym, like what? But yeah, the reputation precedes them and causes trouble for them.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I was thinking about a lot too is that You know, you have all this resistance to them being there. And then, like, how is this story going to get told on this planet once they're gone? Like, what is this going to do to their reputation? Like, they came here to get this stuff and both of the heirs to the monarchy are gone now or whatever.
That was one of the points I was going to say to talk about a little later, but we might as well get into it, is that this may be one of the worlds they have fucked up the most in all their days, because they went in there, got all three of the leading family killed. And if you paid any attention to the backstory, it is that this one guy unified everybody, and it's a fragile piece from previously warring states. And he had secured his legacy with his two children, and all three of them are dead by the end of this episode in a span of, I don't know, 48 hours?
Yeah.
Basically because of the Moya crew. And, like, whoops, I guess that planet is fucked now.
I mean, that seems to me to be a subtle dig at, like, why representative governance is better than oligarchy. Was how I read that.
That's a very generous reading, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, they did really come in and fuck shit up a lot. All because really some dude tried to grope Gianna.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's that guy's fault a little bit.
But it's that guy's fault 100%. I mean, also his sister was like a weird alien the whole time.
No, not the whole time, just at the end.
Just at the end.
Yeah, she was real and herself until the refreshment house where the bomb went off.
Oh.
Because as she was dying, you know, she says something about come to finish me off, my brother. But it's not her brother. I don't know if it was the alien. Like, she was just saying my brother because she thought that it was her brother right. That was going to kill her. But that is when the alien killed her, took her form, and then went to go kill.
I did not follow that while I was watching the
episode.
Yeah,
that was kind of an important part of the
episode.
Yeah,
that makes the episode make a lot more sense to me now. Thank you.
And I think one of the things that's weirdly the most heartbreaking about it is that Papa Rinnick probably pushed the son to the point, you know what I mean? Because there's that scene with John holding him and the squid and the lobster thing, and the John, like, hits on something, and then Papa Rinnick pursues it.
Right.
And not that he's, like, okay with his son dying, I guess, but he's also probably got somewhere in his mind like, oh, my good daughter yes. is still available to me.
Yes.
But then she is dead and he doesn't know it.
Right.
And then the alien assassin assuming her form kills him.
Yes.
So just wiped out the entire ruling infrastructure.
Yeah.
In like a heartbeat. Interestingly, I was thinking about this as I watched it, and then when I went to go read the AV Club review, written by new friend of the show, Alistair Wilkins, who I feel bad that I've never credited him as the author of all the AV Club reviews we've ever cited, which is not so much because I didn't want to, it's because I never bothered to read the byline. And I wasn't sure if it was written by multiple people for a long time, but I now know. It is all written by him. If you haven't checked them out, go do it. He just put up a season four. He wrote like 10,000 words on season four. He put individual episode reviews up for the whole of season four, finally, and for the Peacekeeper Wars right before he left the AV Club. So that is a very cool thing. I am excited to read them in the future. But writing about season three a few years ago, he does say stuff about how in earlier stories where they interfered with the, you know, societal ruling structure, like Thank God It's Friday, the crew had to kind of fight to avoid being beaten by the structure or trampled.
Yeah.
And there's sort of like absurd machinations unfolding around them. But these days, the shipmates don't know their own strength.
Yeah.
And they haven't really grasped that Moya's reputation as a ship of death might be well earned.
Yeah.
And I think this particular incident in their history is almost more damning than the Shadow Depository. Like, if you heard about these people, like, oh man, they robbed this and demolished this fucking bank.
Right.
And then they just, for fun, for like a Tuesday, went and toppled a whole ass government. Just slaughtered the ruling family over 6 linnets of Cremexton. Because you know that's how the story is going to go.
Right. Right. It's the-
like, that is harsh.
Yeah.
And very, very aptly observed, I think. Maybe one of my last notes on the Rinnicks and their situation, though, is that the girl Rinnick is 100% Australian Julianne Moore.
Really?
What?
I'm just...
No, I'm saying she... Are you agreeing with me, or...?
I'm just absorbing the idea that she is, like, a big caliber Australian actress.
No, 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 she's not. I'm saying she looks like her.
Oh, that makes more sense, and you're right. I thought you meant, like, she's the Julianne Moore of Australia.
No, she's just an Australian version of a woman that looks like Julianne Moore.
Yeah, she does.
No, she's, she was in something. I can't remember what it was. I looked up her IMDb. She had something going on.
Some acting.
Oh, the poor, poor Rinnicks and their poor, poor fucked up.
Yeah, just their whole situation.
I feel particularly bad, I guess, because, like, as shitty as the son was, like, we never got any super damning evidence about him.
Right.
That was like, you deserve to die. All that he was shitty to Chiana, complete misogynist.
Uh-huh.
But he, like, didn't ever betray anybody, and his concerns seemed pretty rational from his perspective about the Moya crew.
Yeah.
Like, it's a tenuous piece in this planet. And he knows a lot of, like, local politics shit is ready to go off.
Right.
And he seemed devious, but when he went did the lie detector thing, he was like, listen, I may make a lot of noise, but I've never actually, like, defied my father. And then it's just like, oh, I guess you die now because you weren't always loyal.
Which, like, what does that even mean? Wow. That's so ambiguous.
What is that? Yeah.
I have to wonder how stable any government is going to be if it's built on a mind-reading lobster as the justice. You know, like, if the judicial branch of your society is a mind-reading scorpion lobster, like, maybe you're just doomed and it doesn't matter whether John's there or not.
They seem to have gotten pretty far advanced as a society with that. But I hope that the courts are not packed with lobsters.
Yeah.
I hope this is just a weird family tradition rather than an institutional practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I would definitely watch an episode that combines mind reading lobsters with Dream a Little Dream.
Yeah. Dream a Little Dream would definitely be improved by lobsters that read minds.
I mean, I think it would be that circle thing where it goes the whole way around of being so bad and be good again.
Yeah.
That would be my hope. So there's overall a lot of arguing back and forth with regard to the Rinnick family about if they are allowed to stay, if they should go, if they're going to get the things that they need, if they're not going to get the things that they need, when they're going to get it, how much they pay for it, who the suppliers are. It's a lot. I don't have a lot of interest going into each and every part of it. We can dip our toe into the different interactions, but it is more or less going on in the background, mm-hmm. and I think we've covered most of the interesting parts about it.
Yeah.
Do you want to jump over to what's going on with Crace and Talon?
Yes.
And Aaron?
I do.
So Crace, when he gets up out of his little coma, tries to strangle Jewel, and she stabs him, which is excellent.
Yeah.
And then when Greenshirt John, because he is not yet Moya John, but he will become Moya John, and Aaron run in, Crace does a whole, like, you're alive, my God. And John is immediately like, shut it down, bro. It's extremely not happy.
Yeah.
But of course, Crace, like, waits until John's not around. And he's like, oh, Aaron, BT dubs. Well, what he does reveal, I should say, before then, is that Talon is being pursued, like you said, by the Peacekeepers, by a Pentat class something or other.
Vigilante.
And they've got, like, a pulse that can immobilize them, and they just barely got away. But they're all fucked up, and they're trying to be retrievaled. And then we get some information about Aaron, that Kreese has just been sitting on. And if you remember, he said something about having this chip in DMD, and he was like, it would make her the happiest person alive if we could show it to her, which...
Seems like he doesn't know Aaron very well.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, but I have the clip of kind of how this goes. It's a little long, but I think it's worth listening to.
Wake up, Aaron. Don't be afraid. My name is Zalak Sun. I'm your mother. But you mustn't reveal to anyone that I was here, do you understand? I came to tell you something. Aaron, your life was not an accident. And it wasn't an assigned birthing to fill the ranks. Talon, that's your father's name. He and I chose to have you. You were conceived in love. Our love. I wanted you to know this. It makes you special. We wanted you. And we love you. Go back to sleep now.
My mother.
Yes.
I was never sure whether I dreamt that. And that was on my file.
And hers as well. I thought it might interest you to learn of your parents.
And my father, was he? Did you?
I could find no information whatever about him.
Was my mother court-martialed?
There are gaps in her service record. However, its last entry notes a promotion to an elite battle group. Aaron.
Let me guess. The retrieval squad, she is somehow part of it.
The squad is under the command of Senior Officer Zalak Sun.
All right.
The dramatic violins there really steal that.
Yeah, it really... The music at the end of that is a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, what do you think of this little bit of business?
It just now occurred to me that Talon might not have been a peacekeeper. Like, do we know if he was a peacekeeper?
Like, ever in the series, or...
At this juncture, or ever in the series, actually.
I mean, we only have what Zalak said. I mean, Aaron's sabbation.
Right.
I mean, well, I mean, like, I don't know.
I'm just thinking about the possibilities for that backstory, and sort of peacekeeper society, and how do people fall in love, and do they have enough autonomy, and... I mean, they don't have enough autonomy, like, existentially, but do they have enough autonomy that they can, like, form relationships and fall in love, like, sort of, kind of. Mm. I don't really think I understand Zalak's motivation very well at this point. I don't really understand why you would, like, wake up a child and tell her that and then just be like, okay, go back to sleep. You're a soldier now. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Huh. I would have thought you'd have the opposite argument about, like, this... person trying to make a small but forbidden connection with their child just so they knew something at some point, you know?
Yeah. I'm full of mysteries, Aaron.
Okay.
I'm also just really curious about, like, how there's a recording of this.
I think there was a recording of, like, the room that Aaron was in. I think, like, it's clearly, like, a bunk room for peacekeeper children.
Right, and they're under surveillance.
Yeah, and I think what it is that the camera view, quote-unquote, would have been the initial view that we see of that, and then a lot of it is just Aaron's memory, mm-hmm. kind of. It's like an artistic license. I mean, it's not, like, the straight video, but it is. The establishing shot of it looks like just surveillance footage from the bunk. But I watched this and I think it explains a lot about what Aaron is like as a person and what she's open to.
I think you could be right about that.
I mean, it's this moment that's so singular we know she's remembered it. This is obviously a reference back to something we found out about in The Way We Weren't more than a season ago.
Right.
It was clearly a really formative childhood memory. It's obviously something no one she grew up with would have had any experience with. And it stuck with her. And I don't know. I think you can just see even the child in that. I think they did a good job casting the kid.
Yeah, they did.
By the way. And I think there's that moment where when Zalix asks baby Aaron, do you understand? Mm-hmm. And you get a shot of Claudia kind of nodding a little bit. I think you get an insight into what a sort of cornerstone memory for her that this was. That this was like this little secret thing that she kept inside and kept repeating the details to herself of over and over and over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when she was young. And it wasn't anything she could ever do anything about.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something she knew. And I think having that little seed there probably explain some stuff about her, you know, life post-peacekeepering.
Yeah, and her sort of, I don't want to say willingness exactly, but her ability to be convinced to, like, open up to John and whatever.
Yeah. I mean, in a broad sense, beyond just relationship sense, too.
Yeah. The Aaron and Zalax stuff did not really make a huge impression on me the first time I was watching this, and so like a lot of the details I sort of blew past then, and so I'm accustomed to blowing past now.
Yeah.
And I think that moving forward, I definitely want to make it a priority to take a closer look at all of that and sort of figure out if maybe I'm missing something as a viewer.
I don't think we're spoiling anything to say that Zalix is not, this is not the end of that story.
Right.
They're clearly setting something up to continue for a while. And I'm sort of in a similar boat in that this wasn't a story I loved. And I think there are going to be things about it that I won't love as we go through it. But watching it this time was the first time that I sort of had that sense of what this moment meant to Aaron as a young child, that she kept it the way she did.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are parts of it that are not directly connected to the rest of her life, but like you can see how this moment would have been something that she connected to when she was making decisions shortly after coming aboard Moya.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think overall, I'm not like opposed to this idea of introducing Aaron's mother. I think this is also the kind of story that we usually see between fathers and sons.
Yeah.
And I do kind of like that it's, you know, this mother and daughter militaristic, like, conflict-y kind of thing is interesting. And they've definitely laid the groundwork for this. Like, they had the first mention of this a long time ago. We know enough about Peacekeeper Society to know how unusual or weird this would have been.
And how difficult.
Yeah. And I think it makes sense, too, that the Peacekeepers would try to manipulate Aaron with this particular situation.
Yeah.
And I think there's something very important and very subtle in the conversation that Aaron has with Kreis after watching the clip, where she says, was she court-martialed?
Yeah.
And that means, did they kill her for this? Because that's a thing that Aaron's probably had to live with, too, for a long time, is the idea, the fear of, like, or the idea, I don't know if it's a fear necessarily, but knowing that if they caught her mother for having come and done that, there was a strong chance she would have been court-martialed, i.e. heat death, right?
Right.
And when Kreis says there are gaps in her service record, I think that's such a good little moment of, like, for peacekeepers, that has a very particular meaning, but because we're not peacekeepers, we don't exactly know what it means. It's just bad.
Right.
But I do believe that in the end, like, if she... I think there's an implication here that she was severely re-educated on some level.
Yeah.
And in a way to get back into the good graces in Aaron's adulthood, they're like, okay, you've been re-educated enough, you've done the grunt work enough, now you have to do this final thing because it's useful and we don't like your daughter anymore.
Right.
And she has a connection to this gunship we're really into.
Right.
And a connection to this, you know, rogue captain. But the one thing I don't like about it at this point is it's so immediately and so transparently like, your mom or Talon, choose.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit heavy-handed and takes a lot of the cool nuance around all of this away. And again, it's been a while since I watched this stretch of storyline, but I am, as you are, eager to rewatch it and kind of see how it plays and develops. I remember it having some clumsy moments. I remember it having some good moments.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
And, like, I just don't love Crace in this. I think Crace is being, like, really, like, look, I've done a thing for you, so now you have to like me. Manipulative mm-hmm. is the word that I'm looking for. He's being really manipulative mm-hmm. by giving her this information.
I mean, I think, yeah, on some level, but there's another, like, there's no way he's not going to tell her that the Peacekeepers are after Talon. Like, I think that would be bad of him not to say. And then what was he going to do, like, hide the information that it was her mother?
No. But the, I mean, like, giving her the recording, like, how did he, I think they explained in the episode and, like, it went over my head, but, like, how did he even get access to that?
I believe the explanation is that Talon was designed to have, like, intelligence facilities, so they, like, hacked into Peacekeeper High Command. And he was just, like, scoping out Aaron's file for some reason. Like, that's the part where it's creepy. Because the other part of this is that the part where you have the chip initially, where we first get the idea that he has this information about her, is in DMD, which is before he knows anything about a retrieval squad.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
So it seems like he was married to this idea of, like, letting her know about the stuff that he has. And then it was like, oh, P.S. also, just, like, recent development.
Yeah.
Your mom's involved. But that may just be the story writers kind of being a little bit clumsy there.
I think it's gross.
Although I would not put it past Crace to be that creepy ever in my life.
It's the goatee.
Mm-hmm. But Aaron's on Talon at the end of this. Crace kind of got what he wanted. Yeah. And John's, one of the Johns is there, so.
And the other one's real salty.
I have many things to say about that. I'm trying to figure out if there's anything else I want to talk about in detail before we get to that, though. I guess the thing I last want to talk about is sort of the end of the Rinnick and the Cremexton storyline, where you have John go with girl Rinnick to her freshman house, and there's this goo bomb. Why is Farscape so obsessed with goo weapons? They love it.
I don't know.
And you have girl Rinnick, like, hitting on John
so
in a way that's
weirdly. And he's just sort of, like, politely ignoring it.
There's also some weird double entendres in there. So what does he say? While she's hitting on him, he says some stuff about, like, you don't want to see what our gunship can do. And, like, I'm under a lot of pressure right now. Like, just sort of ignoring her, but also, like, not jumping back that hard. It's strange.
Right.
It's a strange moment.
Right. Like, I'm not into you, but it's not because my dick doesn't work. Right? Like,
yeah.
I'm not into you, but I'm still very masculine.
Yeah. I'm still definitely 100% a man, even though there is another man that looks exactly like me nearby.
Yeah.
But then everything explodes.
Literally.
Because this Zalix soon employed assassin tries to blow them up, and John is spirited away. 100 adorable points to Dargo for carrying John like a baby.
Yes.
Multiple times in this episode. It's very cute. And then we have a moment where I think most people watching for the first time would be like, oh, that John's gonna die.
Yeah.
This is the resolution of that story. But you have a moment where the other John, the green shirt John, who will become Moya John, comes in and is like, nah, I can't. He's ugly and he's shitty, but I can't let him die. And the other John is like, it would be better for us if you did. And the first John does not relent.
Yeah.
Pursues this, which is interesting. And going back to our friend Alistair, writing about this, he was saying, and I sort of agree with him, that it would make so much tragic sense for Crichton to simultaneously accept his death and refuse to allow the death of another being, even if paradoxically that other being is him.
Yeah.
So Moya John does Talon John a huge solid.
And a blood transfusion.
Blood transfusions. And that's fun.
Yeah.
So the other John is okay, or recovering, and he's laid up on Moya. But meanwhile, they discover that the Chromexton is poisoned. The only note I have about that is, why the fuck did you guys not check the purity of your drugs
before you,
if you know you got it from people who kind of had a grudge against you and were giving you a hard-ass fucking time?
So that, we had a conversation about this a long, long time ago about, like, John and trust and paranoia and sort of the ways in which he becomes increasingly sophisticated. And I think this is another one of those uh-oh moments where, like, now they will check the purity of the drugs every single time.
We'll have to check in every time there's Farscape drugs. Well, it's just, it's so much shit that they have to pour into Talon.
Yeah.
It seems like, check it, guys. Check it just a little bit.
Yeah, and it comes in those bags. Like, I think that's just, you know what I think that was? I think that was, like, when you go to, like, the fair and you're a child and they have, like, the thing where you pour sand in the jars and layers and it is a jar full of sand in stripes at the end. Like, I think it was that sand, but just all this red-orange color and just the most of it.
I thought it looked like pink aquarium rocks or something.
Could be that, could be that.
But so they start this process. Crace freaks the fuck out. It's poison! Another thing that's really weird about this episode is that Stark is, like, helping Crace, which I mentioned before, his proficiency with Talon is weird. And the other thing is his willingness to just be like, oh yeah, me and Crace are buddies.
Right.
And I guess Crace was never super responsible for Stark's torture, but he did... He was, like, around.
He was not helpful. He was a peacekeeper. He killed a lot of people.
Yeah. And he did, like, beat Stark up a little bit at the Gamak base once upon a time. So it's a little weird that Stark's just like, forgive and forget. Especially when he, like, wasn't around for Crace's transformation. You know what I mean? Like, renegade shit. I think the first time they've ever interacted after that might be this episode. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, right. The Ugly Truth. Where Stark was like, Crace is a fucking madman who murders people.
Oh, yeah.
It was his fault.
Yeah.
And now he's just like, chill with him. He's just like, oh, no, my friend is dying. Let me help. What?
I don't know. Stark.
Maybe he feels like he owes him for killing Scorpius or something. Well, quote unquote, killing Scorpius. But
I mean, we did see him last week basically saying to Rigel, like, it's fine to want to kill him, but, like, right now it's not expedient. Stark has historically not been really great with compartmentalizing his feelings. And even in this episode, at one point comes over to, I think, the green-shirted John while they're working on Talon and is like, Talon's dying, Talon's dying, Talon's dying. And John does the, like, work now, freak later, work now, freak later. And Stark's like, okay, okay, okay. And then he goes, how much later?
Yeah. Work now, freak later would be a very good gif, I think.
Yeah. I should get on that.
Anyway, speaking of John, the injured John is replaced by the well John in a classic bait and switch. Yeah. Well John goes down to the Rinnick camp and is like, hey, everybody, what's up? What's good? Oh, no, you're hurt. What happened? Like, he's doing his, like, John acting shit all over the place.
Yeah.
One thing I gotta do, true confessions time. Green shirt John in the short leather black jacket with the leather is my favorite John look of all time.
Wow.
It is the only time I have ever looked at John and been like, hello, how are you today? I have a phone number. Do you need it? Like, maybe. like, if you want. Weirdly, any other outfit, I'm like, nah, I'm good. But, like, the second he puts on that green shirt and that black jacket, I'm just like, I don't know what's happening to me.
Aaron, that's so funny because I find the green shirt repulsive.
I don't necessarily like the green shirt by itself. I don't hate it, though.
But it's even when he's wearing the jacket, it's like, I know he's wearing the shirt. I know the shirt is there
waiting. I hate the vest. I hate the vest so much.
I love the vest. I love the vest. I love the black t-shirt.
I love the green shirt and the black jacket. That is, I'm all about that look.
He should have found a different shirt.
That's just who I am as a person, I guess. I'm in fact wearing a green shirt right now.
I'm wearing a black shirt right now.
Whoa. Folks, we didn't even plan that shit. It just happened. But John is, at the end of this episode, maybe heightened by his saltiness regarding his twin. Extremely aggro swagger. Like, the most he has perhaps ever been, as we can see ample evidence of.
So tell me, Rennick, Rennick, and Rennick, what's your problem? We come down here to buy something, we don't hassle you, we don't try to take it by force. Hell, we offer to make you rich, and you guys break out the pyrotechnics.
Violence was an error on our part.
Allowing notorious criminals onto our planet was a worse error.
Criminal? No, no, no. We're businessmen.
Lies.
That's a big word to throw around, son.
Oh my gosh. There's so many good things. The scene right before this, too, where he's talking to them over the comms device, there's even more of this. He, like, opens it with, like, hey, morons!
Yeah.
And then he's like, look at my big gun. I will shoot you with it. And then he starts doing all these threats, right? About, like, we fucked up a shadow depository. We'll fuck you up, too. He threatens to turn the city into glow-in-the-dark sand, is, I believe, what he says. And then he's just, like, so salty with everybody. And, like, you ready to knock off this macho BS? And it's like, John, you are bringing an especially large amount of macho BS to the table.
Okay, here's the other thing about the chlorhexium or whatever. is
supercut of all the things Monica calls Chromexton in this episode.
Do it. Go for it. Chromexton. Is that they talk a lot about, like, it wouldn't all come from one supplier. And that makes mm-hmm. me think that, like, they don't really have the infrastructure to support a demand like the one that John is making. And John does not seem to understand that.
Yeah.
And that, like, actually he's a huge imposition right now and they're busy doing other things, like trying to govern. And, like, his insensitivity to that, I think, is a really interesting development and or consequence of being written by new writers.
I think it's also part of the continuing John development into aggro swagger rude boy. And one of the things that I'm noticing is as he gets more aggressive like this, he starts talking about business more, like, weirdly. Like, he describes himself as a businessman.
Instead,
a criminal, no, businessman, which is, like, the most organized crime thing to say ever.
Yeah. It's really certainly interesting to me, someone who hates capitalism, to hear that juxtaposition. And it's, this is the first time he's described himself as a businessman. He's always been a scientist.
Yeah. Well, he describes himself as John Crane, astronaut, also in this episode.
Oh, yeah. But astronaut, that's the same.
Yeah. I mean, the way he kind of talks about it in this problem, right, is like, we don't want to hassle you. We just want to buy something. We don't try and fuck you up over it, which is in itself a veiled threat.
Yeah.
And then they call him a criminal, and he's like, nah, bro, you got me fucked up. And then boy Rennick is like, you're a liar. And then John's like, what was that, son? And it's like, yo, chill. He's so aggro in this. And it, like, to the point where he eventually starts throwing boy Rennick around the Rennick offices, like, with a gun to his head, having Dargo, oh my god, the very notorious daddy chat.
You've been lying to your daddy, boy, and you know you shouldn't lie to your daddy. It's gonna stop. Who's your daddy? Come on, you know who your daddy is. Who's your daddy? Dargo, tell him who his daddy is.
I'm your daddy.
That's right.
I think that is the most times daddy has ever been said in a 12-second television clip.
Yeah.
Outside of, like, gay pornography.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's so much daddy.
quote of the podcast.
Arguably too much daddy.
Too much daddy. I agree. Too much daddy.
Too many Johns and too much daddy. It's a lot going on in this episode. So the way the episode sort of eventually ends is that we've already talked about the lobster having a reaction to Boy Rennick's sort of lies, and then I guess Papa Rennick pushes the issue, but it wouldn't have happened at all if John didn't put him in that position.
Right.
And then he dies. Everybody goes back up to Moya and Talon with their, like, linnets, and then they clear out the whatever, and then blah, blah, blah. But then you get Girl Rennick being like, oh, we've got to kill them all. And when Papa Rennick doesn't cotton to that, she kills him and then starts the salvos. I like that there's, like, an air defense department that seems to be entirely controlled from a panel in their office. Which is great.
And then she does the exorcist thing and turns into a big, scary... No,
that's later. That's
isn't
later.
It? Okay.
But then while the salvos are going, they finally get Talon to a point where he's fine enough to starburst. And so... John, who's injured, has meanwhile, like, packed up all his shit super covertly when he noticed Aaron doing it, while his twin, who just saved his goddamn life, is down on the planet saving everybody's goddamn life. He's just like, oh, I'm just gonna, like, go. I'm just gonna, like, go over here now.
Yeah.
So he gets onto Talon, Aaron gets onto Talon, Stark and Rigel are still there helping with the repairs. I think Rigel is there because he is small.
Yes.
And Chiana stuffs him into some spaces.
Mm-hmm.
One of my random notes that I might as well say here is one of my favorite things about that scene in particular where Chiana's like, Rigel, get in the walls. Is it made me think about how one of my favorite transitions in this show is Chiana going from a, why me? Why should I? Who, with like, I'm not responsible for shit kind of character to being like, yeah, boys, this is the job. Everybody get on it. Like,
yeah.
She, that transition to her feeling a responsibility for and an investment in the crew and Moya and Moya's baby. Like, she birthed Talon.
Aww.
Like, that's her baby too, a little bit, you know?
My sweet girl.
Yeah, it's really, it's lovely. And I like that it's acknowledged there that she's made that transition from being really bratty to being responsible and like pushing Rigel to be responsible, which is just too fucking cute.
And then Rigel comes back out and is like, I'm being useful. And she's like, yes, you're getting credit for it. Don't worry.
You get cookie points, buddy. Calm down. So they're literally rocking a hard place.
Uh-huh.
Salvo's below. Peacekeeper Retrieval Squad above. So they get through the bonosphere. I don't know what word they're trying to say there. And then everybody starbursts away. And that is the beginning of some shit. And we get, like you said, that coda where we see Girl Rennick go through a really disturbing physical body horror-esque transformation.
God, it was so creepy.
Very creepy. It looks like the Beetlejuice masks. Like some of the Beetlejuice face sculpts from that film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which always freaked me out as a kid. And that definitely gave me flashbacks to that fear. And then you have, very disturbing transformation. And you get this creature appear. And then Zalek soon is like, oh, we failed. But we're still working on it. All right. So a lot of portent at the end of all of this. But the last scene in the episode is one that, like, second true confession time for me. Is we're entering a phase of Farscape where my feelings of empathy and recognition and mirroring to Moya John are intense.
Okay.
This is the most hashtag relatable I ever find it. And the pettiness of this final scene speaks to me on a level that I am uncomfortable with, but just have to own, I guess.
He took Winona.
Oh, well, at least he left you this lovely jacket.
I was wearing that.
Oh, come on. Crack a smile, will you? At least he's out of your nose.
Hair?
Yes, what I meant. At least he's out of your nose hair.
My notebook. He took my notebook and my pen. The son of a bitch set me up. He set it up so that he is on Talon with Aaron.
Now, wouldn't you have done exactly the same thing?
No, I would not. Yes. Man! Maybe. I don't know. I just hope he's having a good time. No, forget that. I hope he's having a terrible time. I don't know what I hope. He just better be taking care of her.
Oh, sure, he's taking care of her.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, the level at which I feel John in that scene is...
Not only do I also feel that, but I also want to make the case that that's actually not petty at all. That in this life where he has very few possessions and frequently experiences scarcity and has like very little to tie him back to his previous life on Earth.
Listen, if you want me to rationalize for 3 hours about why John is 100% justified to be as upset about this as he is, I will. But it's also a little bit petty.
It's a little petty.
I mean, like, in a loving way.
Like, the pen is like, are there not pens in space? Is that the only pen in space? The only
I
pen.
I don't know. He took his notebook, though. He took his girl. He took his notebook. He took Winona. Like, the way that John gets frustrated with the chess pieces and knocks them over is, like, how I go into work every morning. Like, I don't know how to describe it other than that. I'm just like, That kind of, like, burst of exasperation is incredibly Aaron.
Yeah.
And as I'm sure you've experienced.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I just, like, after almost 2.5 seasons of kind of looking at John Crichton as a character and being like, yeah, I get it, but I don't, like, feel it, I'm very much going into a point with the John on Moya where I'm like, yes, I understand you, my man. I understand the left behind one. That is a thing, especially when I first saw this when I was 16, that resonated super deep within my soul.
I love the chess piece work because that is often how I feel. I think you also had said that, but the not even being able to knock over the chess pieces correctly the first time, like, that really resonated.
I don't know. For me, that situation is like, you knock one over, you try and set it up, it doesn't set up right, and then you just, never mind.
I've done that before. I did that in a game of Bananagrams once, and it was amazing.
But yeah, Moya John is going to be very in his feelings for a while, and I can't deny that I'm there with him.
Yeah.
Do you think the other John is kind of an asshole for doing what he did, though?
Not any more than he was before he did it. And I mean, like John basically admits, like, he would have done the same thing if the roles were reversed. And it objectively does make sense to have one of them in one place and one of them in the other.
But, like, the other – Talon John had to know. This is the only thing, is Talon John had to know. That other guy who just saved my goddamn life.
Yeah.
And is only not here because he is continuing to save all of our asses, is going to be super mad that I took literally all of his possessions and am with the woman he loves and incommunicado for an as yet undetermined amount of time.
I think it is often easier for people to be assholes to themselves than to other people.
Well, I think they think of each other as other people, right? Not as him. They spend the whole episode arguing that the other one isn't real.
Yeah, that's true. But then, I mean,
or the other one is not somebody to be concerned with.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and also, like, if green t-shirt John is not really real, then of course black t-shirt John should take Winona in the journal and skedaddle.
Right, but green t-shirt John recognized the reality of the situation enough to save black t-shirt John's life.
Yeah.
Actively and voluntarily.
Yeah.
And, like, even when black t-shirt John was like, it'd be better if you just let me die. I don't know. I get mad at that. I'm like, maybe it has to do something with the way that women are socialized that I feel a particular, like...
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I'm just talking out of my ass of, like... You have to think of everybody in the situation when you act for yourself.
Oh, yeah. I would never do that.
Yeah. of, like, if I knew that I was going to be with you know, the person who we both wanted to be with mm-hmm. for the future. And then I was looking at all of the possessions that I could take that knew both of us had claimed them. I would be like, I guess I'll leave Winona. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like something. Yeah. Some token of like, sorry, bro, but he didn't do shit.
Yeah. That's a dick move. You're right. That's a dick move.
Yeah. Very, very dick move. But that is the episode. That is the setup we get. We got a couple little arcs coming our way, and this is some evidence of them. Do you have any science to yell about in this episode? I do.
Then let's do it. Yeah, let's do it. I do have a science to yell about.
All right. Monica yells about science.
So I think the first science that I want to yell about is John coming to Jewel and being like, Zan took tissue and DNA samples, and like they're just like sitting out like on a shelf, and like that's not how you store that stuff. But then he's like, mm-hmm. run tests and prove that like he's the fake, and it's like what tests with what equipment?
I also had that question, but I think what it had to do with was later in the episode, assuming that the original samples are viable.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Jewel was doing was taking samples from each of the Krytons and comparing them to the original to see if there was any differences.
Right, but it's like use differences in what way? Like DNA, microscopy, like...
Sure, why not?
Where's your... That takes so much time.
It's a fantasy. They can mend people's broken legs in like a minute.
Time and equipment and proper laboratory conditions and knowing how to use a pipette man, which nobody on this show does. I don't know. That bothered me. But really, really the storage, I think, bothered me the most.
Okay.
It's
all space age technology.
Yeah. Shout out to the brainwave sensing lobster.
No shout outs to the brainwave sensing lobster.
Because it's garbage. I mean, like, the brainwave thing, like, okay, sure, I guess I'll buy it, but also, like, why would that ever have evolved? Like, what utility is that to the survival of the animal to be able to, respond to human brainwaves and sense cognitive dissonance? And then also, how did they train that animal to do that? Which it looks like you want to yell at? About?
No, you did the same thing that I want to yell at the episode about, which is inaccurately refer to the concept of cognitive dissonance. So this is Aaron Yu is about social science, namely psychology, a potential profession of mine at one point. So that's not what cognitive dissonance is. It's not lying at all. You can lie and experience cognitive dissonance, but they are not correlated like that. Cognitive dissonance is when you do something or encounter an idea that is contrary to your core belief system. It is about maintaining internal consistency. It is a conflict that psychologists look at in order to talk about specifically how people address resolving that inconsistency. It's not about lying. If you lie, but your internal beliefs are not in conflict with you lying, that's not dissonance. The discomfort is what creates dissonance. So you could have, if something was trained to sense cognitive dissonance, it would sense it if like when Krace believed Aaron to be dead and then saw her, he would experience cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Which is not a good thing to for the lobster to do. If it sensed that feeling.
Yeah.
It would kill him.
I also am just like not, I'm not really convinced that cognitive dissonance would show up in brain waves, because brain waves are mostly about like which areas of your brain are active at different times and like sort of are you in a state of like awake alertness or are you in a state of sleepy asleepness. It's not. My understanding is that brain waves are not detailed enough to really get at content of your thoughts, which is what it seems like cognitive dissonance. Like, it seems like cognitive dissonance is a very sort of neocortex executive thing.
Well, the thing is that the show is using cognitive dissonance as a synonym for lying when that's not what it is, and I'm just yelling about that part. But if I can't – do they say that it – senses brainwaves?
They do. Or... It absolutely does.
I couldn't remember if they said that or if it was something about, like... Because we do have, you know, obviously, ways of measuring people's stress responses.
Yeah.
And you can measure stress response to cognitive dissonance, but that might be indicative of a lie. It might not.
Right.
But I wasn't sure if the crab was about stress responses or about brain patterns.
Oh, no. It definitely said, I definitely transcribed the line, which is what I do when I'm like, I just need to have this here for later because I can't deal with it right now. it's sensitive brainwave patterns and is extremely sensitive to cognitive dissonance. You lie and it – maybe that's just my summary. You lie and it knows and it's been trained to kill.
Yeah. Which doesn't make sense because cognitive dissonance is not
– Not that.
Not a good indicator of lying.
Also, quick science yell shout out to the Jell-O moving bombs. Mm-hmm. I like – the idea of mixing a bomb on the spot, that's always fun. But I don't understand how they find each other or why they had – like why they were – I guess it's to time it. It's how long they take to find each other is how long you have to get out of the building. It's like a fuse. But how they got it to be flubber, I don't know. It's not real.
I don't know either. I thought you would probably like the part where they're talking about stimulants and numbing agents.
Oh, yeah. And Joel's just like, not a good idea to mix those.
I thought you were like, yes, Farscape, that is good science. The way Joel is so offhandedly like, yeah, there's your fucking problem.
I really appreciated Joel in that moment, it's true.
Yeah.
That was a good science.
Yeah. It's always good scientists because where?
I'm a damn scientist.
Do you have any other notes about this episode before we move along?
The one note that I think is actually worth sharing is that I think it's really interesting that the first John, who gets a lobster on his head, manages to like answer the questions but not give away any extra information all about – we need it for the ship or, you know, like, I don't know, the ship is hurt. We're being pursued. Like, none of that comes out. Like, he's finally learned how to keep his mouth shut. And we're just so proud of him for it.
He is a little savvier. He's not giving away as much unnecessary information. That's very true. He, at one point, John makes a joke about the other aliens they've encountered or something, and he's or when he's asking Krace, like, who did this?
Oh, right.
And he says the Skeksis, and I'm pretty sure that's a joke about the vulture aliens in Out of Their Minds.
Oh, great.
Those puppets are literally the same ones that were used in the movie The Dark Crystal, and the name of those creatures and the Dark Crystal was Skeksis. So it's a funny joke about using the pop culture reference that John would have on hand to refer to aliens that are literally the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little fourth wall-y, but I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's very meta.
Yeah. Also, we got to put another notch in the Wizard of Oz reference table.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is how John Crichton refers to himself. He refers to himself as an astronaut, a businessman, and the Wizard of Oz in this, which is... I think that's like a mix of what he is eventually in the show. Another little nitpick I have is, again, I'm not going to harp on it, but I thought Leviathans couldn't just like peace out 100 feet above a planet's surface like this. The upper atmosphere thing I get, but when Talon like is literally looking in the window of a goddamn high-rise building, it's like, okay, you told us this wasn't a thing that Leviathans can do, like, a million years ago. Or something that, like, takes a lot of finesse and whatever. So, not sure I really buy that one.
Maybe it's because he's small? No. Okay, you're not buying it.
He's also incredibly damaged.
That's true. But aren't we all?
I love Dargo and Shiana in the little capes that they have in the alleyway.
Oh my God.
When they're with
I know. John. I know. Got the cloaks, just need the daggers.
Mm-hmm.
I like that that relationship, too, seems to have gotten back to, like, a functional, friendly place.
That was another note I had, where, like, she and Dargo are kind of able to work together in this episode. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not having a lot of conflict. They aren't really, like, at each other's throats anymore, but they've kind of, like, time has passed. They've been through a few things. I think the death of a close friend probably helped to put a few things in perspective. Yeah, so it's good. The only other note I have before we move on is that Marco Shiro, in his review, referred to Zalek Soon as Murder Mom, and he was like, "Hello, Murder Mom," and I'm like, "Yeah,
works.
I feel that. I'm into it.
Works."
So let's move on to 2001, A Hot Take Odyssey. People liked this one overall. I think there was a little bit of, like, lukewarm feelings, but there were definitely a few people who really enjoyed it. A lot of people having notes about it being a more move the plot forward episode. But at least it felt like a release from some of the, like, bleakness of the season so far. And that was really appreciated. And I don't blame them for appreciating it.
Yeah.
One person, when talking about the end of the bleakness, referred to it as, "I feel like Farscape is rolling again. Things are going to be tense, but interesting tense. Not the pure Charlie Brown loses every time tense we've had for so long."
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. I think it captures very well the exasperation that was going on at the time. Lot of feelings about the two Johns and which one Aaron's hanging out with in this episode, because it was a bunch of shippers. Somebody was saying that she, like, picked the one John, but it was, like, circumstantial and thus fair. It's just a weird reaction to me.
That's a wrong take.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how far this show went to establish that they were the same and that everything that happened was circumstantial.
Yeah.
And then the second the two of them are split up, everyone's like, the one with Aaron is the one that matters. It's like, Jesus, guys. Especially after the one on Moya went through all that shit.
Right.
And it's really, really sad. They're like, no, the one who's probably going to make out with Aaron is the one I care about. Although somebody did say, isn't it weird if Aaron were now to mess around with Crichton, I'd feel like she was cheating on him. Which, we'll see how long that sentiment sticks around. Yeah. People were still warming to Jewel. People were, like, really into Jewel by, I think, this point. And it was funny also that you said that you thought that thing was a Scarin, because other people on the forums thought that too. Which I guess is fair in that Scarins, the few times we've seen them, have looked extremely different. But it's definitely not a Scarin.
Right, but it's like, we haven't had a lot of consistency in the Scarins, and we also haven't seen them that much, and we haven't seen them in a while, and it's like somebody with, like, a big, long head, yeah, which I think is the defining characteristic of a Scarin, to me, anyway.
I think its head is long in the wrong direction, but, closing note, poor Aaron, just shut them up and jump them both, and they should both stay happy for a little while, at least. okay. So that is my hot takes spent out. Let's move on to snip, 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 scissors. Ooh, I want to keep this one. I don't, like, love keeping this one, and I feel like it's not gonna make the cut in a few ways, but I do want to keep it. I can't lie.
I mean, it matters for the plot, because they all matter for the plot.
And it's not a bad episode. It's not like, I mean, do you think it's a bad, do you think it's?
I don't think it's a bad episode. I think it's, like, a very average episode of Farscape on the heels of an amazing episode of Farscape.
I think the thing is, though, that I'd rather watch Thanks for Sharing than Eat Me. Like, if I were looking at the two of them and was like, I feel like some Farscape right now.
Yeah.
Usually put in Thanks for Sharing.
I would too, because you get to hear there are some good Farscape-y kind of zingers, which I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to be heartbroken about cutting it.
All right. I will be a little bit when it probably eventually happens, but we'll see.
Right.
Lot of season left to play.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But let's move on to
ratings.
How would you rate this episode, Monica?
You know, I'm trying to come up with a good rating. I'm trying really hard. I'm really struggling.
So hard. I'm so diligent.
I'm really just... How many legs do the stupid lobsters have? Like, 9 out of 9 scorpion lobster legs.
This one's a little tough because it feels like it does. I really strongly grok to that idea that this is a little bit of a breath of fresh air after a lot of airless episodes, mm-hmm. or airless in some ways episodes. And so I think maybe it sort of rises in estimation for me because I think it's a totally adequate story. I don't hate the guest cast that much. I don't think it gets super bogged down in it because it's always kind of like yelling at it. I think if the story and the direction were by people who had done it before, maybe, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. I think that might have fixed almost all of the problems with it.
I would endorse that sentiment.
But there are a few things about it I really strongly dislike than a lot of other episodes we've seen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't have as many favorite parts of it, but I don't have as many, like, ugh, fuck this episode either. Like, I think it's, like, the ugly truth of season 3 for me is sort of how I feel about it.
Okay.
So maybe, like, again, depending on mood, maybe, like, the 3 or 4 spots so far this season. I think I like it better than Self-Inflicted Wounds, Wait for the Wheel, but... Who knows? This is one of those that kind of gets lost in the mix,
yeah.
A little bit of the middle of my rankings. And where do we go from here? Nobody knows. But unless we have any other business, do you want to give us the socials and we can wrap it up?
Yes. If you would like to come talk to us, we are on Twitter at FrailCastShow. We are at FrailCast@gmail.com. You can listen to us at soundcloud.com/frailcast and on iTunes and in the Google Play Store. And if you would like to tip us, you can do that at ko-fi.com/frailcast. That's ko-fi.com/frailcast.
And a note that I don't think we've ever made is that's something you can just do with PayPal. It's not complicated or weird. It's a one-time thing. Just log in with your PayPal and you can do it. I think there are other payment options too, but that's the most direct. Yeah.
Cool.
So that's it for us this week. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Monica.
Thank you, Aaron.
We will see you next week for Ben Browder's authorial debut.
Cross my heart, smack me dead, stick a lobster on my head.